Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording from our May 1st to May 3rd, 2020 True Refuge Retreat. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So the theme of our retreat is True Refuge, and I guess you could call it the theme of our time. I mean, we're all, the whole world is finding ways of taking refuge. We happen to have a very effective form of refuge. It's very well-defined, and this particular sutta speaks to that. It's called the Dajaga Sutta. It's another sutta on the three refuges of the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. And the Buddha uses practitioners of other so-called spiritual disciplines as examples of the high standards that's established in the Buddha's Dhamma and the lesser standards. And this isn't in a negative way. He's not putting these folks down, but making the important point that the Buddha's Dhamma is of the highest standard. And then the way that he defines that higher standard and the contrast to what others were practicing, the contemporary spiritual practices during the Buddha's time. And I'll point it out in the sutta, but where he first uses them, I was wondering where Mary was, and there's the answer. Let's let Mary come into the room. Hello, Mary. Glad you made it. So the Dajaga Sutta, it uses examples of other contemporary spiritual practitioners to describe the highest standards of the Buddha's Dhamma. And he does that. One of the defining characteristics of the Buddha's Dhamma that he points out in this sutta is the experiential nature. Ehepasiko, come and see for yourself. He's teaching that this is the defining characteristic of his Dhamma, that you actually know that you're experiencing it. And so you've all heard me say over and over again to be mindful of that, to look at your progress, to use your deepening concentration and the refined mindfulness established through the Eightfold Path to see things clearly, to see your own progress. So let me read the sutta. And I may get to the Nagara Sutta. It relates directly to this, but let's see how late we get. I don't think any of us want to be here till 10 o'clock tonight. Excuse me. The Dajaga Sutta, the highest standard. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying near Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, once the Devas and the Asuras were prepared for war with each other, Saka, the Lord of the Devas, addressed those of the 33. So these are all magical and mystical names and places. The 33 happens to be an ongoing and continually reestablished magical, mystical place. The 33 realms are supposed to be, legend has it that these are the 33 higher realms that we develop through what the Buddha taught. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. But he's referencing it. And it's interesting that we find that this major distraction was a common distraction even during the Buddha's time and in other spiritual practitioners. So he addressed those of the 33. If fear or terror should arise while going into battle, be mindful of the standard of understanding established by me. When you are mindful of my standard, all fear and terror are abandoned. My commentary. As stated previously, references to non-physical realms and the speculation of inhabiting of these higher realms was constantly and consistently and directly taught to be recognized and quickly abandoned by the Buddha. The Buddha's words, if you are not mindful of my standard, then look at Pajapati's standard of understanding. Pajapati was a well-known and thought to have advanced spiritual understanding. He had a reputation. Pajapati's standard of understanding. When you are mindful of his standard, all fear and terror are abandoned. The Buddha continues, I'm going to cut out a little bit of commentary. In this same manner, if you are not mindful of Pajapati's standard of understanding, then look at Varuna's standard of understanding. When you are mindful of Varuna's standard, all fear and terror are abandoned. In the same manner, if you are not mindful of Varuna's standard of understanding, then look at Asana's standard of understanding. When you are mindful of his standard, all fear and terror are abandoned. The Buddha continues, friends, look at the standards of understanding established by these. Becoming mindful of their standards, all fear and terror might be abandoned, or it might not. So the Buddha is first professing the claim that these other practitioners are saying, that all fear and terror have been abandoned because of my practice. That's the claim they're making. And the Buddha is saying, take a close look, because the fear that they say is abandoned might not be. And of course, he's saying it's not. Why this uncertainty? This is the important point. Because Sakka, the Lord of the Devas, and despite his standard of practice, is not fear of greed, aversion, or of deluded thinking. He can be cowardly, frightened, and quick to flee. The others can do this as well. So he's simply using the example of their own life as saying their standard of practice cannot be a high standard because look at their behavior. What does a Buddha teach? He teaches an eightfold path that includes the key theme of his Dhamma of looking at our behavior, right speech, right action, and right livelihood from the point of view of developing right view. That's our whole standard for Dhamma practice, isn't it? It's how we recognize whether we are have integrated the Eightfold Path or not by our behavior. What the Buddha's pointing out here is that ultimate behavior is of no interest to these other practitioners. In other words, the proof is not in the pudding. The proof is in the belief. Excuse me. And it's not a belief that has to be challenged like the Buddha's Dhamma. It has to be challenged. Again, the Buddha consistently said, and I constantly say, and you constantly all learn, that this has to be experienced to be of any value at all. To be a true refuge, it must be experienced. And that makes true sense. It makes real sense, doesn't it? We can't have a true refuge of our own home unless we're actually in our home, can we? We cannot have a true refuge of the Dhamma unless we actually develop the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha is pointing to as the high standard. It's something that we actually have to do, not just follow, not just believe. Buddha continues, friends, listen carefully. When you have established seclusion at the root of a tree or an empty hut, in the Buddha's instructions on jhana, what he's saying is when you have established right meditation at the root of a tree or an empty hut and fear and terror arise, be mindful that the Buddha is now referring to himself, the rightly self-awakened one, I am consummate in knowledge and understanding. I'm pure in my behavior. I'm unexcelled in teaching those, an important line, fit to be taught. When you understand my standard, then all fear and terror are abandoned. Again, a simple and direct teaching. He's saying these are other practitioners. They're practicing something different. They may or may not reach the same standard that I am establishing for my Dhamma. And this is the standard. All fear and terror are abandoned. Continue. Again, I'm jumping over some of my commentary. The Buddha continues, also, you can be mindful of the standard of my Dhamma. This Dhamma is a complete and timeless path. My Dhamma is inviting and verified by direct experience. There's nothing taken on faith. This is one of the probably one of the most powerful things that I read in the beginning of my true Buddhist practice when I first came across what the Buddha was teaching. And I read that line. It was something that was never taught to me before, to look for the Dhamma in your Dhamma practice so that you can recognize it. I was never taught that. And it was really the one thing that changed my focus from a grasping after concepts or what I think my life should feel like once I'm saved by some teaching, to having the experiential understanding that my mind is just a bit more concentrated than it was before, and I know what to hold in mind. I know what refined mindfulness is now, and it changed everything. That's what the Buddha is referring to here. I'm going to read it again. Also, you can be mindful of the standard of my Dhamma. The Dhamma is a complete and timeless path. Again, timeless isn't speaking at all to eternity, meaning we establish some type of physical eternal life. It's just that his Dhamma is always applicable. It's noble. Those are the four noble truths. In any situation, these four truths prevail. They are the defining characteristic of each and every moment of a human being's life. These four noble truths and no others. The Buddha would often say that his Dhamma is, his words would be, it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and good in its conclusion, or good in the end. What that means is that it's accessible to anyone who is interested, that it actually has a path. It's good in the middle. It takes you along step by step, like I referenced earlier. It takes us by the hand and shows us what Dhamma practice is. It's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it actually delivers. It's good in the end. He's saying this in reference to all the other spiritual practices that he looked at and studied and developed and discarded, because they were like this. They were like these other practitioners. The Buddha continues, when you understand the standard established through my Dhamma, all fear and terror are abandoned. Also, you can be mindful of the standard of a well-focused and well-informed Sangha. We are the example of what the Buddha was talking about 2,600 years ago. We trust each other at this really profound level of intimacy that we've developed, meaning intimacy of the Dhamma. We're able to express it in a way that, at least from, and I think from all of you, but from my standpoint, it really is remarkable, that level of intimacy and honesty we've developed through each other. That's what the Buddha is talking about. We've established it in a Sangha. My Sangha is established on four noble truths and practiced authentically, straightforwardly, and methodically, just as we do. This Sangha of Dhamma disciples is worthy of gifts and hospitality. They are worthy of appropriate offerings. This Sangha is deserving of respect. Through their understanding of my Dhamma, they will bring much goodwill to the world. We had a brief meeting with our four other teachers tonight. I think they feel the same way after that teaching. They understand they're bringing much good to the world, much goodwill to the world. And I'm not even looking for them to shake their heads because they know it. Okay. When you understand the standard established through a well-focused and well-informed Sangha, all fear and terror are abandoned. And, you know, even though we're not in that physical setting of our Frenchtown, and I can see how people walk into that room and take a seat and they start calming down. They start becoming more present with each other in our Sangha. I see the same thing here online, and it is remarkable. You all have developed this somewhat unique in the world ability to be mindfully present for your life as your life occurs. And I would bet that that's changed everything, has it? That's what the Buddha is talking to and referring to these other folks, these other sincere practitioners who simply cannot express a direct understanding of the Dhamma. Why? Because they're not practicing the Dhamma. They're practicing conceptual applications of spiritual or philosophical ideas. The Buddha continues. Why is this true? Because the Buddha himself is free of greed, free of aversion, and free of deluded thinking. He's setting a very high standard for what we should look for in a teacher and what is being taught and the structure of the structure of the classroom, the structure of that Sangha. It must be a well-informed Sangha. Because the Buddha is free of greed, aversion, and the fire of deluded thinking, he cannot be cowardly, frightened, or quick to flee. What he noticed in others claiming some type of, using the term loosely, a spiritual understanding, and yet they still are acting at sometimes cowardly and frightened, and they're quick to run away. He's using his own standard in which to establish the Dhamma within him and within others. And so there's a subtle point that I want to make here, and it has to do with understanding the Dhamma and then taking that responsibility to its most subtle level, which is to be authentic to the Dhamma. When we truly understand the three jewels, as the Triple Refuge is sometimes referenced, like any precious jewel, it must be treated as such. It must be treated as something as something that in a way is fragile because it will yield to ignorance. And we can look at that all around the world, even beginning during the Buddha's time, how ignorance was used to influence his Dhamma and make it something else. And again, even during the Buddha's time, and certainly in the 2600 years after that, this need for a self-referential ego self to reimagine itself, even in something called Dharma practice, is remarkable, and make Dharma practice what the Buddha is referring to here as something that is not quite of the highest standards of his own, meaning it's a pure and straightforward Dhamma practice. We understand it. It's accessible. We know what we're doing. It's good in the middle. And we have the experience of it's good in the end, because we're all expressing that ending, the culmination of the path. We're doing what the Buddha is describing in this sutta from 2600 years ago, and we're making it real today. The Buddha continues. In seclusion, friends, at the root of a tree or an empty hut, established in jhana, be mindful and take refuge in the Buddha, be mindful and take refuge in my Dhamma, and be mindful and take refuge in a well-focused Sangha. Those wise disciples, practicing in this manner, free of greed, aversion, and the fire of deluded thinking, they cannot be cowardly, frightened, and quick to flee. Somebody asked me a while ago, in kind of an arrogant way, they were putting me on a spot, so are you saying that you're awakened? This was someone online. And I hope I never get to the point where I say, yes, I am, because it's an inappropriate question. But what I did say, because this is the truth, this is how I can judge the efficacy of the Dhamma for myself, is I can answer, there's nothing cowardly left in me, and I was a coward my whole life. I am not frightened, and like most human beings, I was scared spitless most of my life, especially having to do something like this, get up in front of people. And I was always quick to flee. Always quick to flee. And I think, again, that's a common human characteristic. I'm not putting myself down like I was a weak human being. I was a typical human being. And all of that fear was rooted in an understanding of a misunderstanding of who I was in relation to the world. In other words, all the fears, all the cowardliness that I had inside me and reacted to was because I didn't understand who I was in the world that I was living in. I created great fear that something terrible could happen to this simply by being in the world, simply by being exposed in society, that something awful could happen to me. Of course, we all know awful things can happen to us, but with a mind that is well concentrated and understanding the framework of the Eightfold Path, we don't take anything seriously. And when you don't take life seriously, you can't possibly be afraid of your own life and your own skin. That's what the Buddha is referring to. They cannot be cowardly, frightened, or quick to flee. Quick to flee from what? From our own lives. When I talk about the Buddha's Dhamma finally uniting a mind in its body and keeping it there, it's because of this. Because we no longer find a me that I have to be afraid of. That's the inner poise that we talk about in the ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption. It's what develops as a consequence of Dhamma practice. We simply know that we're okay human beings. Let me continue. I thought that was, yeah, I just wasn't sure. I'm going to go back one line and then finish the sutta. They cannot be cowardly, frightened, or quick to flee. Those gathered were delighted and informed by the Buddha's words. It's the end of that sutta. So it's a remarkable sutta, isn't it? Especially setting the tone for our weekend. So you're going to hear from the rest of our teachers and actually counting the Nagara Sutta, six other suttas, five other sessions that all relate in some way to what it means to take true refuge. And so what it means to take true refuge is developing an authentic Dhamma that allows us to take that, to truly open the door of the refuge, if you will. It can only be done one way and one path. It's the Buddha's path. That's what this is all about. The important thing, but one of the most difficult things about this, especially to someone beginning Dhamma practice, whether you've been a modern Buddhist practitioner or not, you can't help but have ideas and beliefs and even desires about what you would hope a practice that's providing some answers would be. Like the culmination of the path in the beginning is much different than what we finally realize the culmination of the path is. And so it's a direct experience of the Dhamma. It's not something that somebody says, if you act in a certain way, in a few years or a few million years, you're going to be good to go. In this moment, we know how to practice the Dhamma. And I'm going to get to the Nagara Sutta, and then we can talk about both of them. Because I think seeing this in this way, you'll understand even more deeply why the Buddha came to the conclusions he came to. Let me just see if I can find it. Is that it? There it is. So this is the Nagara Sutta. You've all heard it a few times. But this is where the Buddha describes his awakening. It's something I never heard of before. And in fact, I never heard anywhere that the Buddha ever described his awakening. It was always described in magical or mystical terms. And most of those teachings were, you know that you're awakened when you can recall all your past lives, when you are clairvoyant, when you can read people's minds, when you can float along, when you can travel without your body. That was one of the prerequisites, because it says that the Buddha said that. What the Buddha said was, I'm beyond all that. I don't care about any of those things. I'm awakened because my mind is calm and I'm at peace, not because I found ever new ways to escape my body through these non-physical ways. The Buddha, Nagara Sutta, the Buddha was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, before my awakening, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva or bodhisattva, that one line needs a little bit of an explanation. The most of modern Buddhism and all of Mahayana Buddhism is rooted in the bodhisattva vow. And the bodhisattva vow has two similar ways of expressing itself. One is that I will put aside my own awakening until all other sentient beings are awakened. Sounds very noble, doesn't it? It's not something the Buddha ever said, and it contradicts the first noble truth, that dukkha occurs. The Buddha is saying that as a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be ignorance of four noble truths. So for me to now take the position that I'm not going to awaken, sounds like a little baby, doesn't it? I'm not going to awaken until everybody else is awakened, so they don't, whatever the reason might be. I couldn't be so selfish as to awaken. Well, if the Buddha thought that, there'd be no Buddha, would there be? Because nobody else was awakened when the Buddha awakened and started teaching. He didn't wait for everybody to awaken, or we wouldn't even be here tonight. And the other way that the vow is often taken is the intention that I will awaken, but my sole reason for being here is to stay on the planet until all other sentient beings awaken. Again, it contradicts the first noble truth, doesn't it? It sounds wonderful. It sounds selfless. But it is rooted in a view of self as savior, which is the first thing the Buddha discarded, and you'll hear it in the sutta, as he awakened. We're not here to save the world. We're here to save ourselves and be an example to how that's done to the rest of the world. And we're here to save ourselves in the most practical way, through understanding who we are in relation to the world we live in. And this is how the Buddha came to that description. And just by the way, I took the Bodhisattva vow in a really wonderful 3-day ceremony up at KTD in Woodstock. And it really was a wonderful time. The person who I would call, in fact, I still call him my root guru, even though I don't see him as a guru, was one of the most wonderful men I've ever met in my life, and I still feel that way. He's still going. He's in his mid-90s. His name is Kenpo Carther, Rinpoche, teacher, Kenpo Carther. Very quickly afterwards, when I really understood what I was saying, I had a private ceremony disavowing those vows, because when I really understood it, they were simply a vow that as a Dhamma practitioner was contrary to my Dhamma practice, so I disavowed it. Let me start again. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened, again, just to explain that a little bit more, I forgot the most important part. A bodhisattva is a human being who is imbued with this great desire, great compassion for other human beings. What the Buddha is saying when he's referring to himself as an unawakened bodhisattva or bodhisattva is he was just such a human being. He had great compassion for other human beings, but being unawakened, he didn't know how to help them. And so he didn't. The Buddha didn't do anything in a realistic way, in a practical way, of changing people's way of thinking and acting in a world until he first awakened. And in so doing, he avoided the problem of confusing people even further, even though it was well-intentioned. The Buddha says, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. When he let go of the need to be the savior, he then came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. So if you think about that, how profound that statement is, if I see myself in that rarefied air of being the savior of the world, then the individual difficulties aren't all that much because they don't mean anything to me. I'm above all them. And in so doing, you just lost your connection to the people that are actually suffering. You've lost your connection to humanity because you've established yourself outside of a human being. The Buddha's first thing he did was declare, I am a human being. I'm the one that understands. And I can teach you all how to do the same thing. Do you see the significant difference between what the Buddha was teaching during his time, the radical difference that he did? And you heard me say often, refer to the Buddha as someone who was a radically accepted who he was. He does that. He radically accepts his humanness without the need for it to be any different, without the need for it to establish himself in some magical or mystical realm. He just awakened as a human being. The Buddha describes the difficulty of the world and it's a perfect description of impermanence, isn't it? The world is born. And again, he doesn't describe how the world is born. The world is born. How do we know it's born? It's born because it's here. Again, there's no creation myth in anything the Buddha taught. He doesn't teach about, we talked a little bit about this the other day, about the three lifetimes that are established in the Abhidhamma that most Theravadins claim as a creation myth. The Buddha never taught that. The world is born. It ages. It dies, just like us. It fades away and it returns. But there is no understanding of ending the stress and suffering of aging and death. The world continues. And as long as the world is, again, think about this from the perspective of a Buddha. He's observed all this. This is 2,600 years ago, but it's still a single point in the unfolding of ignorance, isn't it? It's the same point in time then as it is now, is the point that I'm making. The 2,600 intervening years hasn't changed anything of the timeless path. That's what the Buddha is referring to. This is timeless. It's just as applicable during his time as it is now. But there is no understanding of the ending of stress and suffering, of aging and death. When will the world understand the cessation of stress and suffering from aging and death? When will you can hear the plea almost in the Buddha's voice. When will the world get this? Then I had the thought. What initiates aging and death? Now again, it's obvious in this sutta, the Buddha's not talking about what gives rise to physical birth. And in the context of what the Buddha's talking about, what initiates the aversion to aging and death? Because aging and death is simply a consequence of having a human life. What is the required condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? In other words, what the Buddha is referring to even notice aging and death as a condition, what is necessary? What is the required condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding, a breakthrough of understanding. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging and death. It's just brilliant, isn't it? The simplicity of it. But again, remember the context. From giving birth to ignorance as a requisite condition comes reacting to aging and death rather than radical acceptance of it. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is the requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness, it's another important line. It's not just mindfulness. The Buddha's not saying, from me being mindful of washing the dishes in this moment, because it's not that, would it? It'd be another distraction. From his appropriate mindfulness. What is appropriate mindfulness? It's framed by the Eightfold Path, as we'll see. From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. Becoming what? Becoming further ignorant. Then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? Referring back to dependent origination as well. What initiates name and form? Name and form, nama rupa, simply means what initiates self-referential views? What am I clinging myself to? What is the requisite condition that name and form is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes self-identification, comes name and form. And again, consciousness that we're talking about is not some grand conscious cosmic consciousness. It's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Excuse me. Then I had the thought, what initiates consciousness? What is the requisite condition for that consciousness is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From name and form, from self-referential views, as the requisite condition, comes consciousness. But I could say it this way. From name and form, from self-referential views, as the requisite condition, comes a self-referential consciousness. Because now you're stuck in the feedback loop that the Buddha is describing. From self-reference, stuck in a way of thinking that is ignorant of Four Noble Truths, you are now stuck in the loop, the feedback loop. Skipping ahead. Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form, at self-referential views, and goes no further. I could say can go no further. It's our self-referential views, stuck in thinking ignorant of Four Noble Truths, that maintains that feedback loop that keeps us rooted in ignorance. You could say lifetime after lifetime, but what is most related to the Dhamma is not lifetime after lifetime or endless lifetimes. It's what am I giving birth to in this moment? And where is the refuge in that? The refuge is in taking a breath, uniting my mind and my body, and starting to see what's occurring in this moment from right view. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. This is where ignorance is established. From self-referential views, meaning name and form, is the requisite condition that brings consciousness. And from self-referential views, consciousness is the requisite condition that brings name and form. So again, it sounds kind of confusing, but the Buddha is simply describing being caught up in the feedback loop. And so a human mind that is stuck in anything is looking in one direction. It's looking for the out. How do I get out of this? But when you're stuck in a feedback loop, your own thoughts about how to get out of it are reinforcing that you're stuck in it. Again, going back to the previous sutta, to take true refuge in the Dhamma means that we actually have to develop the Dhamma so we can see the feedback loop that we're stuck in. That's the true refuge. It's understanding the my own thinking that got me to this point that makes a Dhamma practice necessary. And it addresses it directly. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, the five physical senses and ongoing consciousness, is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views, and this is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. I'm going to read it again. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, meaning we talked about this over the last 2 weeks, actually, that sixth sense base, our five physical senses and the sixth sense of our thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is constantly reinforcing ignorance as it comes in contact with the senses. It could not be any other way because I haven't established a right view. I'm still stuck in wrong view. And this is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. The Buddha is teaching us right here that it is being stuck in that feedback loop of self-reference bouncing off of confined by its own thinking or by my own thinking. My self-reference is maintained, and I would say it's tenaciously maintained until something intervenes because of the way that I think. And so it points directly to the experiential nature of the Dhamma again. There's not some outside intervention save the Dhamma or save the triple refuge that's going to have any effect on me. In other words, I can pray all I want, I can visualize all I want, I can find all the right people to associate with, and whatever it might be, whatever I decide is the external condition for my salvation, or I can practice the Dhamma. Because an external resolution is arising from that feedback loop. Does everybody see that? Does everybody get that? So it's the feedback loop that the Buddha is describing here that kept him in ignorance, and it's what we overcome through Dhamma practice. Let me finish this. Excuse me. So listen to this next part and apply it to your own Dhamma practice. I'm asking you to think about this, and we're going to talk about it when we're done. What was your experience of what the Buddha is describing here, what I'm describing? Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose. Discernment is another way of saying right view. Knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. And that, again, this isn't grand cosmic ideas. We're talking about learning who we are. Then I had the thought, what is the condition that the cessation of the stress and aging is dependent on? The Buddha continues, from my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of birth, meaning in this moment, from me ceasing giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, as the requisite condition, comes the cessation of the stress of aging and death. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of consciousness, again, the Buddha, these are one of the things that point to how to read these. The Buddha's not saying that we stop thinking, is he? It just wouldn't make any sense in the context of what the Buddha's teaching, how he lived his life, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, the Buddha's not saying we stop thinking or we develop some kind of amorphous trance-like state for the rest of our human life. He's simply saying we abandon ignorance. From the cessation of consciousness, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes a cessation of self-reference. Comes a cessation of name and form. Listen to the next line. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of name and form, from the cessation of self-referential views, as the requisite condition, comes a cessation of consciousness, comes a cessation of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's a mutually symbiotic path. We're not excluding anything of our own thinking, of our own ignorant or wise self. It's all appropriate for the Dhamma, which leads to the notion of refuge and applying the Dhamma in all situations. We have the perfect opportunity because most of us are not going to be able to maintain a retreat scenario, meaning seclusion and quiet for the whole weekend, but we have an opportunity to constantly practice taking refuge into all areas of our life. The Buddha continues, I have attained the following path to awakening. So the Buddha is declaring what his path is. Again, how could there be any ambiguity about what the Buddha taught? I have attained the following path to awakening. From the cessation of name and form, from the cessation of self-reference, comes a cessation of consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of consciousness comes a cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes a cessation of the sixth sense base or the sixth sense media. From the cessation of the sixth sense media comes a cessation of contact. What the Buddha is saying, again, these aspects of our being that we use to continually reinforce ignorance are no longer in play because of our own understanding. From the cessation of contact comes a cessation of feeling. We're now no longer using our feelings to reaffirm ignorance. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming further ignorant. From the cessation of becoming further ignorant comes the cessation of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of giving birth, then aging, sorrow, death, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. This is the cessation of the entire mass of stress. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Another important line that is contradicted by much of modern Buddhism. It said that the Buddha taught endless paths, pick whatever one you like, that the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are just archaic teachings, but pick anyone, pick the Bodhisattva path. The Buddha is saying something completely different. This is the path he taught. In this way, the Buddha continues, I saw a timeless path. Let me just go back because I didn't put that in the right context. What I just said is the Buddha's reference to dependent origination in its reverse. In other words, he's teaching us how to undo the links of dependent origination, the clinging associated with it. The Buddha's words, in this way, I saw a timeless path to be traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. This is the path. If we want to become rightly self-awakened, this is the path the Buddha teaches. In his words, his rhetorical question, and what is this timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones? Just this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Again, this is the significance of this sutta shouldn't be overlooked. This is the sutta where the Buddha describes his awakening and declares the path to awakening. This is the ancient timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. I follow this path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the cessation of the stress of aging and death. And you know, the other thing, aging and death is also a description of simply human life. He's talking specifically about the unpleasantness of aging and death, but he's also using those two words to simply describe, human life and to de-emphasize the reaction to aging and death. It's simply life. Every human being that is born will suffer. They'll age and they'll die. It doesn't matter if you're alive for a week or you're alive for 100 years. It's still part of a human life. And so the Buddha is talking both specifically and in general terms there. I followed this path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth, becoming, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the sixth sense base, and name and form, consciousness, direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness, and direct knowledge of the cessation of consciousness. I came to direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of consciousness, and I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications, and direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path, leading to the cessation of fabrications. Knowing this directly, I have revealed it to monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers, so that this undefiled life has become powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed among many beings. That's the end of the Nagara Sutta. What a powerful way to end it. Once he's described this whole thing, he's now telling us, I put it out into the world, and already it's made this incredibly powerful change in all these people, in monks, nuns, male and female lay followers. And so that's still continuing today. Understanding the natural feedback loop that we all develop as a consequence of having a human life is key to the Dhamma and key to taking refuge. You'll see going forward how the rest of these suttas all relate in one way or another to taking true refuge and understanding how we can extricate ourselves from that feedback loop. So that's my talk. Let's go around the room. I'm going to start with David because he's right down there. How are you, David? Hello, David.
Hey, John. I'm going to use you married.
How are you, David?
Good, John.
Good.
I thought the first student was a good example of what you often say, what the Buddhist Dhamma is not. And that directs us to the second where you realize that the Four Noble Truths is redeveloped. So I thought that was a good combination of teaching this evening. And just to sign a note for the weekend. Again, I'm looking forward to tomorrow's teachings of our teacher.
And thank you for this.
Yeah, I wasn't. You were breaking up a little bit, David. I didn't hear everything you said, but I'm so glad you joined us. And I too am looking forward to our other teachers and what they're teaching. I'm glad you joined. Mary, how are you?
Can you guys maybe mute either David or Mary? I think that's the problem, is we're hearing both of you, so it's hard to hear what you guys are saying.
There we go.
Okay. Hi, good evening, everybody.
Good evening, Mary.
Thank you for being on and all the teachers. I'm really looking forward to the weekend. It was a great sutta to kick things off. You know, we're all always wrestling with our feedback loop and, you know, looking to improve that so that it's positive and skillful.
Yeah.
Based on, you know, wisdom and a good rigor of a practice. So I think this was very good and will give me something to think about this evening. And I look forward to the rest of the weekend.
Yeah, me too. Thank you, Mary. Glad you joined us. Rom, how are you? There he is.
There we are. Yeah, the Nagara Sutta is one that I can just keep reading, and I always have this feeling that I'm not quite getting this, but this is such a foundational teaching that you cannot read and hear this sutta enough.
Yeah.
He really lays out how he got to this, and not just his understanding of the human condition, but also the path to be happy with this human condition, to be calm in this storm of an existence sometimes. I've already spent quite some hours with this sutta, and I can do much more than that, because it's the keys of everything are in here.
Yeah.
This is, you know, when you want to understand how he got to the Eightfold Path, you have to go over this sutta line by line and make sure you understand every step that he takes here. And there are some skips and things in there that we have to pay some real attention as to why he goes from one to the other. But it's foundational.
Yeah. Thank you, Rami. To me, it should be required reading for anybody who's a serious Dhamma practitioner. But I came across it almost by accident. I'm just reading a lot of the suttas and in the beginning, just trying to make sense of what's this guy trying to teach me. And this is one of the few suttas that I read it, and it did change everything. It put the focus where it belonged for the first time. So, it's why we refer to it often too. You know, such an important sutta. So glad you joined us tonight. Looking forward to your teaching on Sunday, Ram. How are you, Matt?
Hi, everyone. Good to see everyone here on our spring retreat via Zoom. Just a very adaptable group, being able to congregate and join together online and talk Dhamma. So that's what we're all here for, and that's what we're demonstrating as we come together and hear the words from the Buddha.
Yeah.
These are great ways to start this retreat. Coming back to taking refuge, and you know, there's sort of a mini, you know, John opened it up by saying, come and see for yourself. Come and directly experience the Dhamma for yourself. And so we do that by taking refuge on our cushion. So when we come and we sit and we get quiet and we unite the mind and the body and do jhana, that's our refuge. That's our personal refuge. Then we have the refuge of the Sangha. We come together and we have the refuge of the Buddha's Dhamma, where we hear how a human being practiced in this way and developed a calm and peaceful mind. And so that's why we're here and that's what we're doing. And it's so good to see everybody doing this together.
Thank you, Matt. We have such great teachers here at Cross River Meditation Center. Hello, Michael.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
That was a really well presented and interpreted job you had done there, John. I'm not going to actually go into commenting too much. I just want to say thank you for it. It was riveting and definitely. I paid a lot of attention to it, and I'll catch up with you another time on this when I'm more prepared to give a rightful understanding of everything that's on these pages. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Michael. Hello, Julia.
Hi, John. I enjoyed the talk on the two suttas. I just wrote down one little thing because, and this is on the. I don't know how to say the sutta. Dahaga.
However you say it is fine.
I wrote down this question that kept on appearing over and over, and it said, "Why is all fear and terror abandoned when we understand the standard set by the Buddha's Dharma?" And so I wrote that down as a question to myself, and then I answered it, of course, because I said I have to answer that question, otherwise I don't really understand this. And so I answered it as because we realize that there's nothing that we can hold on to, and we don't waste our energy trying to hold on to things that are impermanent. That's just like the basic, simple, yeah. Simply said, yeah. That, with three marks of existence, of course, that we understand that everything, ourselves, our ego self, and everything in our environment is impermanent.
Yep.
And so this is why we are not afraid in the Buddha's Dharma. We're yes. Safe.
Yeah.
So that's... That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's outstanding. You, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
No, I said thank you, John. Yeah, right. Thank you.
Thank you for your teaching, Julie. It is. It is from understanding Four Noble Truths that we are free of fear, that we've abandoned it. And it's just that way. And we know it because we actually experience it. Somebody else doesn't tell us. You know, while we're still full of fear, somebody's saying, you're okay. Everybody's going to take care of you and all. If the fear is still there, the fear is still there, isn't it? So,
yes. Just,
exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Excuse me. Jen, how are you?
Hi.
How are you, Jen?
Hey. Oh, hey, everybody. We have some weather today.
Excuse me.
For our first day of retreat. And I think... it's awesome that we all set this intention to meditate and learn the Dhamma this weekend, even though we're doing it virtually. I noticed that in my I was meditating and feeling like I was on retreat because, you know, I had set this intention with all these other people, and that's all you need to do. So thank you, everyone, for your right intention and right effort. And I look forward to the rest of the weekend.
Thank you, Jen. Hello, Karen. I'm going to unmute you.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
Now? Oh, okay. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Karen.
Oh, it was so lovely to hear you, John, because, you know, if I read these suttas on my own, I just get so confused. I can't figure it out. It's like a totally different language, but you just make it so clear. And tonight in particular, really, both suttas really just, I love listening to your interpretation or your explanation. And it just feels so great to be in this group this weekend. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm so glad I signed on. And that's it.
I agree with everything you said. we're talking about taking refuge and how fortunate we are to take refuge in this particular sangha. So it really is remarkable. I think every one of us has said we can't wait for the rest of the weekend. So get your heads out of the future and be prepared.
<Right. laughs>
Thank you, Karen. I'm glad you joined us. Becky, how are you tonight? Hello, Becky.
Hey, John. I'm fine. Hi, everybody. It's just wonderful to be here with everybody. I miss you, Matt. Yeah, I just wanted to really echo what everyone else has said, especially want to thank you for this sutta again, because as Ron said, it is the foundation. Yeah. And going through it this time, I really realized that it really teaches you how to practice Dhamma.
Yes.
And it really teaches you what the steps are and where you can get derailed. It's an amazing sutta.
Yeah.
And I appreciated hearing it so much again and hearing you explain it. And I realized that there are things that I'm doing that it is possible. It is possible to have a sense of true, of right view, and know when you're there and know when you're not there.
Yep.
And get back there. But it takes a massive amount of concentration. You have to keep going. And this sutta, again, just reminded me of that. And it was wonderful to be here with everybody and to hear it again. Thank you. So glad you're doing this.
So am I. I can't remember. I think it might have been Michael's idea when I first said we're not going to have a retreat this year up at Juan Dharma Center. Was it you, Michael, that said, why don't we have one online?
I think it was Trevor.
Was it Trevor? Thank you, Trevor. That was a great idea you had. And Becky, thank you so much for your kind words. But again, we're talking about the experiential nature of this. It has to be experienced. And what, you know, when I think I was saying, mentioned this to Lorna one time, over the years, as I'm reading the Buddha Sutta, I really feel like he's become very familiar to me, like a good friend. And when you start looking at how the Buddha taught and the subtle intricacies of what he was able to see in the world, such as this, to see that level of distraction hiding in sincere spiritual practice, to me is remarkable, because we have his perspective to see. He didn't have his own perspective until he was able to develop it himself. I don't know if I'm describing this right. But his simple understanding of the intricate complexities of subtle ignorance is just remarkable. And he's able to teach it. And that's why he's so effective in saying, this is what my Dhamma is, and this is what it isn't. And they're both equally part of Dhamma practice. And it's so important to see it that way. Thank you, Becky. Ram, you moved, didn't you? I already got to you, Rob. Kevin, how are you?
Doing well, John. Really nice to see everyone. I want to continue to echo what other people have said, to take refuge with all of you in the Sangha week to week. And now online is something very, something that I cherish a lot. And it's really great to be here with you. I think what we do is pretty rare in the world, as we said, and I think we can be pretty common that this is maybe even more rare in the world. I don't know how many sanghas maybe are online and online at that for 3 days and really focusing our attention onto the heartwood of the Dhamma. I think that this sutta, as Ram said, is essential. And the more we become familiar with it, we're able to understand that this path leads to cessation. And cessation is a very personal concept, right? We have, as you've been saying, we've all been saying, we have to experience the release of stress, the release of ignorance, the release of wrong views. And just excited to continue to do that with all of you. So thank you very much for all being here.
Thank you, Kevin. Trevor, how are you?
Doing great.
Was this your idea?
I don't know if it was my idea.
Take credit for it.
I remember us discussing that, maybe online. So I'm so happy it happened.
Me too.
John, thanks for your teaching. Really excited for the teaching to come from the other teacher. So thank you. Sincere thanks to everyone for their preparation. For me, this Dhara Sutta in particular, just seems, as others are saying, incredibly important, partly because the same language shows up in the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just paramount that we understand this. And I'm also with what Ram said earlier. This is really difficult to grasp. I mean, I would love to just be able to sit down and pick this apart, in detail. For me, as I'm, and it's helpful every time we go over it, for me, what I'm thinking today is, when it references birth and death in dependent origination, to me, it comes across as purely metaphorical, birth and death. And I wonder, first of all, if you would agree with that, or I mean, I would say that it's happening on different levels, but yeah. It seems to me the main point is a metaphorical understanding of birth and death.
Yeah, what a great question, and I think it's both. As disappointing as that answer might be, because the Buddha is. Everything the Buddha teaches is just utterly practical. In other words, when he's saying birth, sickness, aging, and death, he's saying you're here. You don't need to worry about where you came from or where you might go, birth or death. You're here. That's all anybody needs to know. Where are you? Right here, right now. Have this life you're living and be a part of that life. And so where you came from or where you're going is not part of Four Noble Truths. But then he also, as we develop the Dhamma, we understand that the Buddha's use of the word birth relates to what we're giving birth to in this moment, what we're manifesting here, based on what we're holding in mind. So again, we mentioned it a few times, the subtle intricacies of what the Buddha's addressing can often only be discerned as you're developing your Dhamma practice. And when I first read this sutta or any pick a sutta, I didn't understand the subtle depths of it. It took, quite a bit of Dhamma practice to understand this. But these same teachings are what we're using. I mean, it we're still using the Buddha's words to awaken, aren't we? You know, and that's remarkable. It's what keeps us, as a well-focused, well-informed sangha that is actually taking refuge in the three jewels. So,
thank you. And I just to tag on to that and see if this is headed in the right direction. So when I look at it as metaphorical, what occurs, and kind of try to interpret it with that lens, it's this, and also the self-referential views that you discussed today. It's almost like we take our lives, and so this is about what gets birth in each moment. We look around, there's this external visible world, and including ourselves, and when we, our bodies, for instance, and when we look around and we identify with any of this external situation, we're quickly running through all of those processes at the of name and form, consciousness, six sense media, believing that we're making contact with the external world, perspectives, rise to feeling, craving. We orient in a certain way, develop cravings that leads to suffering. As those, whatever we've attained ends up, whatever we've identified with eventually ends up being impermanent, fading away.
Yep.
And therefore dying. So to me, this is suggesting we need to find our identity in something other than our understanding of self, in something other than anything visible or external.
Wow. Yes. Talk about getting to subtle level. So ultimately, I guess you could call it this. We create an identity as someone who understands. You know, and that really is the only identity that's worth having, isn't it? You understand who you are in relation to the world. That's what the Buddha teaches. So I don't apply any speculative teaching to, or any speculative self-establishment that I cannot directly experience myself. It's just utter reality. But again, that's what the Buddha said. We can either continue to give birth to ignorance and keep playing the magic show for ourselves, or we can take to the Dhamma. And again, I say it's a path of ease and joy, but not for the faint of heart. I know how difficult it is because I've done it. I've seen all of you. You struggle with it at times. But it is a path of ease and joy, isn't it? That's awful difficult at times because of that. Because we come up against everything that we thought about ourselves and have to recognize that's a fabrication. You know, it's a fabrication. It's not based in reality. And how do we know again? Because the Buddha taught us. What do we have to weigh it against? We weigh it against an eightfold path that develops understanding of Four Noble Truths. It's Dhamma practice. So. Thank you, Trevor. Jane, how are you?
I'm fine, John. Like everybody else, I feel very fortunate to be able to take refuge with all of you.
Yeah.
The Nagara Sutta was the first sutta I listened to. It was on one of the retreat tapes and had a very powerful influence on me. I mean, I didn't understand a lot of it, but I knew there was something really, really good there.
Yeah, I did too. I think the first time I read it, I was a little upset that the Buddha would be putting down these other fellows. Like, you can't say bad things about anybody. But that was part of my own conditioned thinking, wasn't it? You have to in certain situations. You have to do just what he did because he's a Buddha. He's teaching us how to awaken. He's not concerned about how it being politically correct or anything like that. Thank you. Josh, how are you tonight?
Good, John. I'm so happy to be here with you folks and hearing everything. I had an experience just listening to your talk about he was addressing the concept of fear and terror. And this morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke in a panic attack thinking of death. And as a result of your talk this evening, I can start seeing now that it was my reaction to the thought of death rather than really looking at it as and how it's kind of connected to this false concept I have of myself. And how the Buddha was able to gain insight to seeing that it wasn't really the self that dies, as I understand it. Well, the self has to die. The false self has to die, and then we lose all fear. And I don't know if I understand all that, but that's where I'm at.
That's pretty good, Josh, for a couple of weeks of Dhamma practice. So you you got. I forgot where are you joining us from?
Grand Junction, Colorado.
Yes. So this is. I think everyone has met Josh. Maybe not yet. So this is a new Sangha member, Josh from Grand Junction, Colorado. You have joined one or two classes, but this is a great time to start with us too. So welcome to our retreat Sangha and just welcome to our Sangha in general. So,
thank you.
We're so pleased to have you. Wow, that was really a wonderful start to our retreat. But none of you answered my question. Does anybody remember the question? That's okay. So just think about this, not just tonight till tomorrow, throughout the retreat. Notice when you're caught up in this feedback loop that the Buddha is describing, and notice as you are thinking yourself out of it. That's Dhamma practice. So just be mindful of that and developing this this incredible refuge that we've all been given after all these years, just developing it to a much deeper level. And I can't wait to hear the rest of these teachers. So anybody have any questions or comments? Okay, so our schedule's on the website, and I think it's in the email too, but on the website. We begin tomorrow at 8:30 with Qigong with Matt, and then our first session is 9:30 with Jen. And the other, just to reiterate what I started this with, just remember that this is your retreat weekend. So maintain the retreat as best you can as we sign off and you go back into your moment by moment life, and distractions will arise. Take a breath, come back into the true refuge. And in that way, you really are establishing the whole weekend as a weekend retreat by holding in mind the Eightfold Path, no matter what's occurring in your life. It's a wonderful learning opportunity for all of us. And you know, I was talking to Larry Carlson earlier today. And again, we're just talking about what an opportune time this all is to really practice Dhamma. It is. We're all there. Have a wonderful evening, you all. I'll see you all tomorrow morning at 8:30. And thank you for a wonderful start to our retreat. Peace.
Thank you, everyone.
And we should thank Bodhi for being quiet. Thank you, Bodhi, for being quiet.
What?
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.